You're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome, Niners, to another episode of The Orb, our dedicated Deep Space Nine podcast. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Matthew Rushing. Now, Matthew, as we record this show, tomorrow is St. Patrick's Day, so I was expecting to see you, you know, with a glass of Irish whiskey, but instead it looks like you've got a single malt scotch in your hand. Now, what's going on there?
Oi, well, you know, we're going to be talking about Miles Edward O'Brien today, and so I thought I'd go with his favorite drink, which is, strangely enough, he's not a whiskey drinker from Ireland. He's a Scotchman, and that's great because I like my scotch. It's delicious, and it's the drink of the gods. So, yeah, that's what I'll be doing today, just really celebrating with Miles. Gonna maybe go down to the pub later and get me a pint as well. The scotch is not enough.
Well, I'm sure, Miles, if you're going down to the pub, while you're there, they've probably got something, you know, like a jukebox or something that needs repairing, so you can put your technical wizardry to work as well.
Oh, that's, of course, that's what I do there, laddie. Gives me free drinks.
All right. So today we are going to talk about Miles O'Brien as we continue our examination of the main characters of Deep Space Nine. And, you know, Miles he's kind of a tough one, Matthew. We've covered Sisko and Kira and Bashir, and they're all kind of easy to talk about because they were new characters for us at the start of Deep Space Nine, and they all had pretty clear arcs through the series. You know, we could follow their growth. But O'Brien, he was an established character coming into Emissary, and he truly is the ordinary man. And his character development is a lot more subtle and a lot more nuanced than what we're used to.
It is really true. Miles is one of those characters who is quite steady throughout the series, although you will get those Miles episodes where he has a very interesting character arc within the episode, but it's not quite the same as, say, somebody like Julian or Kira or Sisko, where you really feel like they've kind of moved from the beginning to the end. It's in the ways that he does, it's a lot more subtle. And so, you know, looking over his life as a character, I was actually just surprised to see how much Miles' life, how full it's been. And I think that's one of the interesting things about kind of diving into him tonight, because a lot of what's happened in his life has really made him that kind of steady person, the one that you can always count on, kind of the rock. I always like how Serena Douglas talked about him and saying that if she had to replace Atlas, she would pick Miles, and that he would do it with a smile. And that's exactly the picture I always think of when I think of Miles. Just the kind of person that you could lean on anytime, anywhere, because he's always going to be, you know, just kind of the center and the rock.
That's a good way to describe him. He is a very loyal person and a very reliable person. He truly is that person that you can always count on to be there when something goes wrong, and usually to figure out a solution for it as well. Well, as we've done with our other characters, why don't we start off? You talked about how full his life was up to the point that we met him even. You know, it comes out bit by bit in various episodes, but we do come to learn that he has, by the time we roll around to Deep Space Nine, more than 20 years of experience in Starfleet. As well as a lot of stuff going on in his childhood before he joined Starfleet when he was 18. he had a very, very full life. So as we have been doing with other characters, let's start off with his early life. And there are some interesting little tidbits about his childhood that I think influenced the kind of person that he became. When you look at his early life, what do you see that stands out to you?
One of the things that I really noticed was, and it's something that Miles brags about, but the fact that his family was raised on real food. They didn't eat replicated food at their house. And, you know, to me, this really just goes to making him the quintessential everyman, and really the guy who's the most down to earth of any of the characters. You know, he's, I think, really, in a lot of ways, our window into Deep Space Nine, because he's the one that's most like us. And this really, I think, stems back to this idea of, in his family, they prized eating food that was grown in a garden for real. You know, it's not replicated. And this has a huge impact, I think, just about his outlook on life and what it's supposed to look like and some of the simple joys in life that a lot of people in this time period kind of don't remember anymore. You know, eating real food, drinking a real drink, you know. I think you can see, too, just we were making fun of earlier, but, you know, Miles likes a nice single malt scotch. Not replicated, you know. There's a big difference, and I think this really has a huge impact on his life.
Right, yeah, because, I mean, just food, it may seem like a simple point to a lot of people, but it's that distinction in how you're raised, and in this 24th century environment, it is that distinction between those who are maintaining a more traditional view of life in the world versus those who give themselves completely over to the incredible technology that's available to them. And you can kind of see that today, even a little bit. Now, obviously, we don't have replicators to make food, but you know, we are already having a lot of genetically manipulated food that's available
that's
to
true.
Us. You know, there are artificial meat being created. There are a lot of questions about whether that is safe to eat, for example, how it affects us. But at this point in time in the 24th century, of course, that's all come to pass. And it's very easy for you to just basically rely on replicators and technology for absolutely everything. And really, you could be raised to have really no understanding of how to do anything manually in the world. But what we see in Miles is the exact opposite. You know, we're going to talk about a bit later. He's a technical wizard. He is the everyman. He's very much like us. He's clearly someone that was raised from childhood to be connected to the actual real world environment and do things in a traditional and a manual way. And I think that just really, really sets him apart from most all of the other Starfleet officers that we see in Star Trek.
Well, one of the other things that was interesting that came out during the series was the fact that when he was younger, he was apparently a really good musician, a cellist, and his father really wanted him pursuing music. And Miles didn't want that, and so he went instead and joined Starfleet as an enlisted man. And I just think that that's really interesting, too. I think it goes along with who Miles is. He's a very unassuming guy. He doesn't need to be an officer to be happy in Starfleet. He just wants to do his job and do it well to the best of his ability. And, you know, he always seems to excel, too, in what it is that he's doing. And I think that kind of hardworking blue collar attitude in some ways that he seems to have has really been cultivated from this humble beginning and somebody who's very comfortable in their own skin, knowing what they want to do. And, you know, Miles doesn't want to be a musician. He goes and he does what he wants to do. And he really then excels at it. And, you know, even later, his father tells him how proud he is of him. And so it kind of pays off in the end, even though they've had quite a few years with separation between them. You know, in the end, it actually all worked out. And I think that's, you know, it's just really cool, staying true to who you are. And Miles really gives us a picture of somebody who is comfortable with who he is in his own skin, and he's not going to change for anyone else.
Right, and he's very hands-on. You know, he decided to go into Starfleet, and he did it in a way that got him out there in the field right away so he could be making a difference and doing things. It kind of reminds me of someone, my father was like this. He was very much wanting to be hands-on and doing something. He didn't want to be sitting behind a desk, for example. And he had a job where he got promoted and he got stuck behind a desk. And he decided to leave that because he wanted to be back out there doing things. And that's what I see in Miles a lot too. You know, he wants to be that hands-on. He doesn't care about the rank. He doesn't care about the career path, you know, starting from a cadet and maybe making admiral someday. That's not him. He's the everyday guy who just wants to make a difference for people.
It really reminded me, Chris, too, of, I don't know if you've ever read Citizen Soldiers, about the everyday soldier in World War II for the Americans. And the book is really talking about just the way in which these everyday soldiers, the privates, you know, the enlisted men who really made the difference in the war during World War II. And this is what I think of when I think of Miles, you know, that they're just the everyday guys who really make this happen. You know, they're not officers, they're not admirals, they're not anything like that. They're just men who are willing to put their lives on the line and do their job really well, even be inventive in it and really make it their own. And this is something that I think, you know, when we look at Miles, he really does. And it's really something to be able to look up to, and to aspire to really take pride in who you are and your work, and to not just be looking for necessarily the next best thing. But I think Miles is more concerned about making himself the best thing, I think.
Yeah, that's a good description of him, which will lead us into the next topic, which he's a very well-traveled man. You know, he got into Starfleet and he got out there in the field. And you talk about these soldiers in World War II, and he's very much like that. You know, he was involved in a lot of events in the Cardassian War. It's the reason why he has such animosity towards Cardassians when we see him in Deep Space Nine. We learn as time goes on that this was, what, around maybe the fourth season of DS9, where we're told that he has been involved in 232 separate combat engagements, and he's actually served on 6 different ships during his career. So he had a major backstory prior to the time that we met him in The Next Generation, even. And it was taking place out there in the field like that, and it was making a difference in the conflicts that the Federation found itself in. And so ultimately, in turn, just as those soldiers in World War II were doing for the world and for freedom, he's doing the same thing for the Federation.
Well, and he is, you know, decorated by Starfleet 15 times in all of those combat situations. And because of them, you know, the Setlik 3 massacre gets mentioned. And he is one of the heroes there because of his technical genius with a transporter that he is able to...
Right. He saved 13 Starfleet officers.
Exactly. Exactly. And so, you know, this is just a guy who is using all of his gifts in the best way that he can for the most people. And I think that that's pretty awesome. And you know, it's what's so interesting is that he goes from all of that to then he gets on the Enterprise, and by that time he spends, it's like, I think I read like 20 years operating transporters.
Yeah, 22 years, yeah.
Yeah, it's a long time, you know, to go from all these kind of engagements and everything to just being the guy in the transporter room waiting for somebody to go in and be like, can you beam me to the planet, please?
Yeah, I think he did a few more things on the Enterprise, though. I mean, we saw him move around a bit, but he was primarily the guy who was in the transporter room when someone needed to beam out. Now, it was a little bit better transporter room to be in than, say, Mr. Adventure in The Search for Spock. You know, he was in that really dark room with Uhura.
But there
was a little more action taking place on the Enterprise D, I think. But yeah,
that's true.
But you're right. But then again, I mean, we know from his backstory that he had great expertise in transporter operations and repair. So the fact that he was there, maybe he was in there because he was also heavily involved with maintaining the ship's transporter systems. You know, maybe he had a little bit higher position than we are led to believe just by what we see on screen.
Well, I mean, and two, his last job that he has on the Enterprise is transporter chief. Yeah. And so it does seem like that he is the head of the transport department. And, you know, Picard does say that that was his favorite transporter room.
That's right.
As well as Miles' favorite transporter room. And, you know, so I think that that, again, just speaks to the steadfastness and the loyalty of who Miles is as a person. And it really gives us something to look up to, that there's something to be said for somebody who does the menial job or the job that might not get the best acclaim. You know, he's not a captain. He's not sitting in the captain's chair, but he still has a very important role to play. And he does it to the best of his ability and even exceeds in it, you know. And so, I mean, he's the transporter chief on the Enterprise, the flagship of the Federation. It's a pretty high honor, actually.
Well, it is. And so all that perseverance in his work leads him to being transferred to DS9 in 2369. And that's where things really pick up as far as we're concerned as viewers for his career. And he becomes, though he's just a chief, one of the most instrumental players on behalf of the Federation in saving the Alpha Quadrant as we know it, really.
Definitely one of the most important. I mean, you know, without him to be there with Rom and Jensia, you know, he wouldn't have thought of the self-replicating minds. You know, he wouldn't have been there as well to save the station every time it almost blew up, to make Federation and Cardassian technology work together.
Right.
I mean, this guy had a way with machinery that even some Starfleet engineers didn't. I think especially when, you know, Sisko brings the Defiant back and the ship is completely overpowered for its small size, and Miles is able to find a way to make it work where other engineers couldn't. And I think that just speaks to the way that he thinks outside of the box, you know?
Yeah. I think that's the thing. Now, of course, we saw in past Star Trek with Scotty, for example, Scotty was good at thinking outside of the box and making things work. I think that the average Starfleet engineer is probably kind of by the book. I mean, they're really good with the Starfleet technology. If you threw them into a situation where they had to make Starfleet technology and Cardassian technology work together somehow, they would probably struggle a little bit. That's just my feeling. Whereas Miles, I think his hands-on, his down-to-earth upbringing, and his just field experience, having to improvise, made him the right person to be able to come in and get the station back on its feet. He kind of reminds me of, he's like a mix between MacGyver and Joe from News Radio. That's how I think of Miles a little bit. Now, it would have been really cool if Miles had used duct tape for everything the way that Joe on News Radio did. And not only that, but like Joe, if he had made his own duct tape, because, you know, that stuff they sell in the stores, or in this case on the promenade, that's just a ripoff.
Yeah. I really think that Miles probably has his own special version of duct tape that he's created that, you know, can withstand space pressure. Like, it's that good. So if we can find a way to market that, Chris, I think that would be great.
I'm sure Cork could find a way to market that for Miles.
Well, yeah, but then he'd put his face all over it. Would.
You unroll the duct tape and it's got Cork's face over and over and over. It's like those little sticker tapes that children get that have the characters on them.
Oh, man, that's, yeah, goodness.
That'd be awesome. But yeah, he was definitely the right guy, and he had a special talent with machinery and technology to make things work and to keep things running and to find solutions when they didn't have access to the Federation, to parts and all the technology that someone aboard a starship like the Enterprise would have access to.
I mean, I just think back to Emissary, where they need to move the station from Bajor to the mouth of the wormhole, and O'Brien is able to find a way with this, you know, broken down old station to be able to do the science in his head and figure it out, all the calculations that he needs to basically reduce the mass of the station itself so that it can move faster with the thrusters that he has available. I mean, that's some technical wizardry right there.
Yeah.
And, you know, kind of really sets the stage for what he's going to be doing. You know, he, of all the Starfleet engineers that we see after Scotty, he's the one that reminds me most of Scotty.
Yeah.
Really, I would say the miracle worker, able to just kind of, you know, do the MacGyver thing where he pulls out his special space duct tape and his, you know, toothpick and a, you know, hairpin from Janzia, and he's able to create, you know, a warp drive.
Right. Yeah. I think they went for that a little bit with Trip on Enterprise, but I think you're right that Miles probably is the closest to being that kind of miracle worker that Scotty was. Well, okay, while we're talking about him and technology, I tweeted this one day recently when I was watching Deep Space Nine, and I said, you know, when Miles spouts technobabble, you believe it. Because, you know, you have shows like Voyager that are just so technobabble heavy, and it's to the point where you're like, okay, that just didn't make any sense at all, but I get it. You're trying to move the plot along. Okay, I'll go with it. But with Miles, and it's something about Kolmini's delivery. You know, when I watch Kolmini, whether it's in Deep Space Nine or it's in anything else, I never feel like he's acting. I feel like I'm just watching Kolm. It's just him, and he's this ordinary guy. And he's able to deliver this technobabble in a way that makes it really feel real for me. Like, oh yeah, okay, yeah, I buy that. He's teching the tech for reals. That's what I always say.
When I read that you had put that on there, I thought, you know, that really does make sense to me, because as I'm watching through the show, as long as Miles is telling me something on screen that's technical, it does seem like it's coming from a real place, even though I know he's making it up.
Yeah.
And I think you're right. I really do think it's just the delivery that he gives, and the way he just, I think Kolm kind of has that way of earnestly giving you a line with no pretense, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
He's not.
Yeah.
I think that's really important. You know, he's just not pretending to be somebody who's in space. He's just pretending to be a guy doing a job. And I think that that really brings credibility and kind of an authenticity that you hadn't really seen since Scotty, honestly.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's one reason why I've always connected with Miles, despite the fact that he doesn't have the grandiose character arcs of someone like Sisko or Kira. He's always been one of my favorite characters, whether on The Next Generation or Deep Space Nine, I think for that reason. Okay, before we move on into other areas, one thing that we did want to point out, because we're kind of at that point in the series right here, Miles, the Miles that we knew from The Next Generation and the Miles that we knew kind of up to this point in the series, gets killed. And it really gets killed and gets replaced for the rest of the series.
I thought that this was really interesting, that you have a character and he gets replaced, and it's not necessarily an alternate timeline or anything like that. It's Miles from the future. So, right. You know, he has, you know, a couple hours on the old Miles. But I just think that's a really fascinating idea of kind of dealing with that you know everything that Miles did, but you also know some things he didn't because you've lived longer. But then you watch yourself die. Like, that's a mind bender right there. I'm not really sure how much therapy that would require, but it seems like it would require a lot to kind of come to terms with that.
Yeah, it would, and it's just an interesting little tidbit for me. It's and the way it happens, I think a lot of viewers don't even remember that there was this kind of replacement of Miles by another Miles from a few hours into the future, and it's just an interesting little twist to the story that I always kind of remember. You know, we had that similar thing in Voyager where Harry Kim is replaced by another Harry Kim.
Yeah, and that one wasn't as good, but we're not going to go there.
Although they do tend to beat up on Miles in DS9 the way that they beat up on Kim in Voyager, though.
That is something that when you watch through Deep Space Nine, Miles is probably the most unlucky character ever. And maybe it's because he's just that normal, everyday Joe. But everything bad that can happen to somebody seems to happen to Miles. I mean, he gets falsely accused and put in prison. He's there for 20 years. You know, he has his wife taken over by some evil aliens. His daughter gets caught in a weird time loop thing. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. And gotta be the most unlucky character in Star Trek.
He is definitely one of the most unlucky characters, for sure. Okay, so we talked about his engineering prowess and his technical skills, and we talked about his music a little bit in the beginning. He's what you've described as a jack of all trades. He really has a lot of interests, a lot of hobbies, a lot of professional skills as well, and a lot of talents. What are some of the other things about Miles that you enjoy and that stand out and you think, you know, shape how he interacts with everyone?
Well, one of the things that, I just kind of made a list of some of the things that he's done. You know, he's obviously an engineer. He's been a spy. He is a family man. He was a flight controller on the Enterprise for a while. He's been an inventor. By the end of the series, he becomes a professor. And that doesn't count the fact that he's also known as a tactical officer, a good soldier, a musician, sportsman, model builder. I mean, the list kind of goes on and on.
Don't forget, he's an expert historical battle reenactor.
That is true. In fact, wow, I'm surprised that they never did a, Civil War reenactment, since those are so big. They probably got there. I mean, they did all the others. And let's not forget, Miles speaks Trill, or at least he can read it.
Right. Isn't that interesting?
So, yeah, that's really impressive. He must have just picked that up on one of those half a dozen ships he was on before the Enterprise. So
probably. Maybe he was using the Rosetta Stone Trill program during his off-duty hours.
Yeah. You know, he started with Trill. He was going to go to Klingon. He didn't quite get there. Trill's actually pretty tricky. So,
I think they roll their R's, don't they?
Oh. I've never heard a group of aliens do more with R's than the Trill. It's quite insane, actually.
Right. So he has a lot of stuff going on. I mean, the model building stuff even comes into play, as does the music in The Next Generation. You know, when he was aboard the Enterprise D, he actually was a member of the string quartet. We got to see him playing twice in The Next Generation, in The Ensigns of Command and in Sarek. And so that's something that he kept up, you know, even 20-something years into his time in Starfleet, which I'm impressed with because, you know, I'm a musician. I'm classically trained. That's what I studied in school, and I performed in a professional orchestra for 7 years. These days, I don't play very much at all because I have no time. Yet this guy manages to save the galaxy and continue to perform in a string quartet. So I'm impressed with Miles O'Brien.
Well, it's about priorities, Chris. And Miles just knows how to make music a priority in his life because he knows that music enriches the rest of his life. So
he does. All right. Well, why don't we talk about his relationships and his loyalty? You know, you talk about people being salt of the earth, and I think that's Miles, and I think he's salt of the station, if we want to call him that. As we've discussed, he's one of the most ordinary guys in all of Star Trek, and he's very loyal to his friends and to his family and to Starfleet, but also to his ideals. You know, there are those moments where he'll do something that maybe goes against Starfleet regulations because he feels it's the right thing to do for his friends or others who need his help.
This is something that I really thought was very interesting, and they really portray early about Miles. And the prime example for me was when the Tosk visits.
Yeah.
And Miles gets to know him and gets to know his situation, and he goes against basically the prime directive to help the Tosk. And I also thought it was really interesting because in that, Miles also learns who that Tosk is and that his life really is the hunt and he wants to be a part of it. And so I really like the way he's also able to justify it by saying that, you know, really he was just giving them the hunt they wanted. So for me, that was really been the prime example of Miles sticking up for the things that he believes in. And to me, almost, it seems very Kirk-like. You know, Kirk was not afraid to kind of impose what he thought was right or wrong on other people. And I think Miles kind of has some of those same convictions, that he has a very clear sense to himself of what's right and what's wrong. And he's not afraid to share that with others or follow that code, even if it's against, you know, maybe Starfleet regulations.
We talk a lot on here about how Deep Space Nine portrays the world in shades of gray, whereas most of the other Star Trek series are much more black and white and kind of tell you this is how life should be and you need to come down on this side of it. O'Brien, on the other hand, I mean, do you feel that O'Brien kind of sees the world in black and white a little more so than some of the other characters like Sisko, for example?
Yeah, I actually think of when he was on the planet with Julian, and Julian really wants to help these Jem'Hadar.
Right, yeah.
And Miles' view is very black and white when it's compared to the way that Julian is approaching the situation. And you can see it very clearly that for Miles, there isn't an alternative other than escaping. And it's because I think he does have this very kind of black and white view of the universe. But instead of that making him like a character that I don't want to react to or I don't want to like, I really love him for it. And maybe it's because he's kind of a sea of tranquility in the middle of, you know, the raging Bermuda Triangle that's around him, known as Deep Space Nine.
Yeah. Well, yeah, the Jem'Hadar situation is the first one I think of as well. And it is a black and white view, but at the same time, you can completely see where he's coming from. You can see he may have a real point here. And although you feel that, yeah, life is not black and white, life is filled with shades of gray, there are, I think, some truths in life that are black and white. And when he does come down that way, and maybe it's because he is that ordinary guy that you can really connect with, you don't necessarily see it. It's not like the writer's preaching to you black and white. Like a lot of TOS is that way, right? It's here is life's lesson. This is how it should be. This is how you should do it. You don't feel that way when Miles comes down on that. You kind of see the reasoning behind it. And given his history, especially with the Cardassian War, you can understand why he feels that way.
Yeah, and I think, again, even though Miles is not a character who moves and has a huge character arc, you can see Miles change and kind of morph into somebody who's even more comfortable, I think, with the kind of the chaos around him. I think he's really affected, especially by his relationship with Julian, in that they become a lot like each other as they spend more time together. They kind of influence each other in some interesting ways. And I think Miles does begin to think a little bit more outside the box, especially in those later episodes when he's undercover and with the Orion Syndicate. Mm-hmm. And he's having to think through the issues of what he's doing and why he's doing it. And he becomes this person who does start to see, I think, more of the shades of gray of life than just the black and white.
Well, as we get into his relationship with characters, let's go ahead and talk about Julian, you know, Miles and Jules, and what you're just talking about there and how he comes to differ a bit towards the end of the series. Do you feel like his friendship with Julian played a role in that?
I do. I think they start to spend so much time together. I think Bashir's kind of carefreeness about life and his joy about life really rub off on Miles. You know, a guy who I think that one of the reasons he goes to kayak over and over and over again and always hurt his shoulder is he kind of needs that escape. And even the pain of his shoulder is worth it because he needs a way to kind of vacation from life. He has a very full life. He's got a family and he is trying to hold this station together, especially for the longest time with, you know, spit and polish.
And duct tape.
Exactly. And space tape. And so I think that Julian just gives him this fun side again. But at the same time, I was thinking about this and I think Hard Time, the episode, is one that really stands out for me of Miles seeing a completely different side of life. You know, he goes to prison for 20 years. He's not
in
actually
his mind,
guilty of anything.
Right.
In his mind, yeah. Yes. And in there, he kills someone. And when he gets back to the station, you know, he confesses to Julian that, you know, if it had been you there, I would have killed you. That's how I felt. It was that I had that much, you know, rage inside of me. And Miles wants to end it all. And he's about to commit suicide. And Julian is able to talk him out of it. And I think this really forms a bond between these two guys. But I think in some ways, that's also the point where we really start to see Miles not see the world so much in black and white. Especially when it comes to things like, you know, when you look at the Orion Syndicate and those people involved in that kind of activity or things like that. But I also think, you know, Miles would have killed himself if his best friend hadn't been there for him and been worried about him. And I really like, the more I watch that episode, the more I really like it because it's a really dark episode character-wise because you have your everyman going through one of the worst situations ever. And getting to the point where he's willing to murder somebody and then having to find a way to live with that.
Yeah, I don't know. That's one of those cases where on the surface they beat up on Miles, but it does do a lot to shape his character and I think affects him after the episode and moving forward. And I think the kind of the Julian relationship and Keiko relationship, his marriage to Keiko, are kind of intertwined a little bit. I feel that Miles and Keiko's marriage is, I think, a real portrayal of marriage, something that we never see on Star Trek. You know, we tend to see very few married couples. We see a lot of these quick and sometimes bizarre relationships between characters.
You wouldn't be referring to Seven and Chakotay, would you?
Seven and Chakotay, Troy and Worf, Jadzia and Transparent Skull Guy. But you know, I mean, I know a lot of people don't like they don't like Keiko. They don't like the character of Keiko. But I think that's really a real relationship that we see with the two of them. But bringing it back, because we're talking about Julian, the reason I switched gears here to Keiko and kind of mix these two relationships together is that Julian is sort of a retreat from the stress of married life for Miles. We even get that moment late in the series where Miles basically confesses to Julian that he wishes Julian were his wife, or at least he wishes that Keiko were more like Julian. I think that the relationship with Julian helped to kind of take some of the pressure and the stress off of Miles, and that helped him to grow a bit as the series went on as a person.
Well, and I think in some ways it even helps him appreciate what he does have at home with his family.
Yeah.
Because you can tell that he loves his wife and he loves his kids very much. You know, I always think back to when he did have the opportunity to put a move on Kira.
Yeah.
When she's pregnant with, you know, Kiryoshi, and he doesn't. They stop themselves, and as much as there's an attraction there, there's something else deeper inside of him that he's loyal to his wife, he's loyal to the commitments he's made, and he's also loyal to his friend, Kira, and all of those things put together, he's not going to just throw that away for something trivial, and it really goes to show just the strength of what it means to really be married, and Chris, I know you've been married for a long time, and that it's not always roses and fireworks and, you know, lovey-dovey notes. Sometimes it's hard stuff, it's fights, it's all those things, but in the end, it's about the commitment you've made to each other, and, you know, you can tell, even though I don't love Keiko, I think it's really just the way she's portrayed.
Yeah.
The marriage itself and the stability of it, I think, is a really beautiful picture in Star Trek. And I'm glad that they gave us a picture of a real marriage, one that has lasted the test of time.
Yeah, yeah. I agree on Keiko. I'm not crazy about the character either. I think it's the casting, largely. She comes across as very whiny. And I think that having Rosalind Kyle play Keiko on The Next Generation was fine because, you know, Miles marrying someone on The Next Generation was a very minor storyline. When they were both transferred over to Deep Space Nine and then Keiko had to have a much bigger role on the show, I think that it didn't quite work as well. And so that's probably why some people don't like Keiko so much. But as you say, the marriage itself, I think, is really important to Miles, to the character, and it does help to show that these types of human relationships and interactions remain the same, even if the surroundings change, and even if the technology around us changes, and, you know, the circumstances are transferred from just your everyday commute to the office here and get the kids to school to a galactic scale where you're helping a planet recover, you know, from a devastating event like the Cardassian occupation. The basic human relationships between a married couple like that pretty much stay the same.
And one of the things, to go back just a little bit, I think that Miles and Julian's relationship helps show that married people need a good friend of the same sex to really be able to talk some things out with and just be able to hang out with, away from their spouse, because you do need some time away, and that time away is good for you. You can get some perspective on things, get a new outlook on things, and those relationships build you up and actually make you better for your marriage. And I think I really liked that they portrayed that too, because again, that's it's very realistic. That it's important to have good friends, especially of the same sex, outside your marriage, to give you that place to vent, or to just give you some perspective that you might not be able to see, especially inside your relationship.
Right. Yeah, I agree. And I think the Miles and Jules relationship is probably the best friendship in all of Star Trek, because they're two ordinary guys. I mean, Bashir is genetically enhanced and all, but they're two people who are basically on the same level with one another within the crew. You know, they're not like Kirk and Spock, captain and first officer. They're not that type of relationship. They're two fellow crewmen who have this incredible friendship together that is constantly challenged by circumstances, but it's always there to the end. And I joke often about Miles and Jules just because it's kind of fun to joke about them. But really, seriously, probably the best friendship in Star Trek.
It really is. And I think that one of the things that I like about it is that it shows the importance of friendship in our lives. And I think when I look back to TOS, it's the friendships that I remember the most, of Kirk, Spock, and McCoy. When I look at the Next Generation, I kind of think of the friendship or the kind of mentor relationship between Data and Picard. And then when I get to Deep Space Nine, I think about all of these friendships. When we've talked about all of these characters, we've always talked about them in conjunction with the other characters. And so I really think of, you know, obviously Miles and Julian, but I also think of, Kira and Jadzia and their friendship, or as we're about to talk about, Miles and Worf. And I think of Sisko and Dax, and both Daxes, actually. This series was full of people with very close friendships and relationships. And I think that's really because, you know, Deep Space Nine stays where it is, and it really becomes right about community.
And I think that's a strength of the series. You know, a lot of people complained, especially early on, that that was a fault of the series, that there was no ship traveling around everywhere and it was stationary. But I mean, if you're looking for pure adventure, seeing strange new worlds, then yeah, maybe so. But if you're looking for good character development, exploration, and good storytelling and good drama, I think that having everything come to them and having them be together all the time is actually a strength. So, of course, Miles had relationships with all the different characters on the station, but the only other one we're really going to talk about today is the relationship with Worf, because this goes back to The Next Generation, and they're reunited halfway through Deep Space Nine. But Worf plays some unexpected roles in Miles's life and in the lives of the O'Briens in general.
Yeah, one of the best parts that I like, just for the way that Worf kind of has an impact on the family, I think of Worf babysitting Kiriyoshi.
Okay, yeah.
And the way that, you know, just Worf responded to that, but he did it because, one, he was taking care of the O'Brien's child, and he felt very honor-bound to do that to the best of his ability. But also, doing that really helped Worf see that he wanted a new family of his own with Jadzia, and I thought that that was great for that to happen. I also really think of in Starship Down, where Worf is having a really big problem getting people to follow his leadership. And it's O'Brien who kind of guides him and shows him the ways to talk to the engineers so that Worf can be more effective in his command there. And it just goes to show, again, we were talking about O'Brien being this everyman, you know, a jack of all trades. He has learned a ton from serving under so many great men. I mean, you know, from Picard, his former Captain Maxwell, Sisko now, he's picked up a lot of things on what good commanders do to lead well, and him being able to share that in a way that doesn't threaten Worf, but it just kind of slowly teaches him, I thought was really, really neat to see.
And maybe Worf is more receptive of that from Miles than he would be from someone else, I think, because Worf is, he's kind of like almost family to the O'Briens, right? You know, he delivered Molly in Disaster on right. The Next Generation, which was a bit humorous, as you know, the situation of Worf delivering a baby, but it also creates a bond between Worf and Keiko and Miles. And then because of their past general experience serving with one another on the Enterprise, I think when Worf does come to DS9, O'Brien is that person who he can latch on to as being familiar, being someone who he has a history with. Because when you go into a new environment and you're new there and you don't know anybody at all, it's really difficult to adapt and get yourself into the flow of things and come to be accepted. And that's what you see in Starship Down. I mean, he is having difficulty being accepted by the others. But then there is O'Brien there who can be like a buffer between the crew of DS9 and this new Klingon who has come in. The crew trusts O'Brien, and Worf trusts O'Brien, and O'Brien trusts Worf. And that makes it all work. And I think a lot of that does come from the bonds that they had formed with one another and these family moments as well.
Well, and one of the other things that I think of too is that, you know, after Jadzia had died, it is only O'Brien who's able to get out of Worf what's going on inside of him. And, you know, finding out that Worf is worried that Jadzia won't go to Stovacor, and doing that over quite a few bottles of blood wine. And I loved seeing the fact that, you know, Miles is able to be there for Worf because of his connection of them being on the Enterprise and now their connection here on Deep Space Nine. And then I love that the next time that he comes over with the bottle of blood wine, they don't even have to drink it together because Worf even says, "Not again." And it's because of Worf's treatment of Ezri. And I like the way, I really like that scene because I like the way that O'Brien talks to Worf, because he's really curt with him. He's very tough with him. He's like, "Look, there's no way that your wife would like the way that you're treating Ezri right now. And you need to stop it." And just that knowing how to, I think, talk to Worf is very important. And you know, honestly, that, you know, just a little Klingon tough love is what he needed.
So definitely Worf's relationship with O'Brien is an important one. And it's that bridge that we get between the Next Generation and DS9 as well. One of the bridges, and one that I appreciate. So we've been talking about Miles for close to an hour now, I think, Matthew. So why don't we wrap up for today? We'll touch on more points about him in future shows, no doubt. But what are your final thoughts on Miles O'Brien?
You know, I was thinking about this, and, you know, I haven't really given a lot of thought, I don't think, to the character of Miles. And part of that is what we've talked about, is that his character development is so episodic in a lot of ways. But in the end, we do see Miles make some moves, and his life kind of gradually change throughout the series. And what I'm drawn to him when it comes to his character is really his character, just what makes him tick, the fact that he is this man who is extremely loyal. He's a man who has strong moral convictions. He's a man who really wants to excel in whatever it is that he does. And he wants to be the best, and not just because he really wants recognition, but he gets this, he seems to get joy from just doing his job and doing it well. And I think that he's really somebody that you can look up to, because at the same time, you know, Miles is flawed. He's very human. He's definitely not perfect. He makes a lot of mistakes throughout the series. but he's the kind of man that I think anybody would be proud to be. And so when I think of Miles, I do think of him as being this kind of like Atlas-like character, you know, holding up Deep Space Nine with his bare hands, and really holding that place together in a way that I think everybody can count on him. And because everyone can count on him, it makes him indispensable. And in a lot of ways, when we talked about Janzia, we talked about her effect on the other characters and the way that she helps them grow. I think Miles does this as well. I think he has that effect on other people. He really is able to influence them, to steady them, to show them a way of living that is very attractive, of just doing the best you can, being loyal, being a great friend, and enjoying life. And I'm not sure you could say really anything better about Miles. And he's somebody that I would aspire to want to be like. And I think that says a lot for a character.
Yeah, he's that steady influence. He's always there. Everyone can count on him, and they know he's there. And it makes a really big difference. And the other thing you see here is that, you know, he enlisted in Starfleet after he failed to get into the Aldebaran Music Conservatory. And in the end, when we get to What You Leave Behind, he returns to Earth to accept a position as a professor of engineering at Starfleet Academy. And this is an enlisted man, not an officer. You know, it's not Geordi LaForge, who eventually becomes a captain. It's not that. It's an everyday man who enlisted to make a difference and ends up going back to the academy to teach other young men and women to do the same thing. And I think that's wonderful. So, Matthew, let's tell everyone where to contact us if they would like to share their thoughts on Miles. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and send to the Orb. That'll come to both of us. If you want to have a bigger discussion, you can go over to our forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section there for the Orb. There's also one for Deep Space Nine. And you can join in and talk to us and the other listeners there as well. You'll also find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm and on Twitter under username trekfm. Now, Matthew, what if people want to find you personally?
Well, yes, Chris, I am on Trek FM doing the book reviews as well as on Literary Treks, talking books and comics with you. And then, of course, if you would like to get in touch with me personally, you can either find me on the forums or at Twitter, where I am MattRushing02, trying to talk about all sorts of things, keeping it interesting, but of course always enjoying talking about Star Trek. So if you do find me and follow me, let me know. That way we can talk about whatever it is that's interesting you about Star Trek these days or anything else.
Excellent. And if you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter as well. My username is CBrianJones. That's Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username. You'll also find me on the forums along with Matthew. And you'll find me elsewhere on the network, again with Matthew, doing Literary Treks every week where we talk books and comics, and also in the Ready Room where we talk all the Star Trek series. We rotate from TOS through Enterprise back around again, talk about a lot of news as well, so go check that out. And while you're at it, we'd like to invite you to go to iTunes. If you enjoy the show, go and leave us a rating and leave us a written review. We'd love to hear from you. And that'll help other people find the Orb and enjoy Deep Space Nine as well. So we really appreciate your support and appreciate you listening.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us, and we will see you next time as we gaze into the Orb.